We're excited to kick off this season again with Midwestern Seminary back as our flagship sponsor for the spring. Located in Kansas City, Missouri, Midwestern Seminary exists for the church by biblically educating God-called men and women to be and make disciples of Jesus Christ. Midwestern's For the Church vision permeates everything they do, from classroom experience, faculty membership, and includes their new 100% tuition scholarship for first-year residential master students through their For the Church cohorts. It's unbelievable. You have to go check this out. Even if you're unable to relocate to campus, Midwestern Seminary offers flexible and fully online undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees through their global campus, which is designed to allow you to stay rooted in your current ministry context. If you're ready to begin your theological education, whether to move forward in your vocation, to be a more faithful leader in the life of your church, to be a more active and engaged disciple maker in your local context, I could not more heartily encourage you to apply to Midwestern Seminary for free with the code KNOWINGFAITH. You can apply to Midwestern Seminary for free with code KNOWINGFAITH at mbts.edu/apply. Go check out all that God is doing at Midwestern Seminary this year.
You're listening to Knowing Faith, a podcast of Training the Church.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-host Jen Wilkin and JT English, and we are just keeping this train going. How's it going? How are y'all doing?
Well, I'm doing great, Kyle. How are you doing?
Oh, so good, Jen. Thank you for asking. JT, how are we doing today, man?
I'm doing great, Kyle. Thanks for asking.
Man, wow.
Did you finish your lunch, JT? You were kind of chewing a little bit there towards the...
I did. I nibbled a little bit between some meetings. I feel bad. I just made nachos. It's like I felt like I was in third grade again. Came home, you know, popped in some chips and cheese and chicken on a plate and heated it up and went for it.
That's great, man.
Yeah, feeling real good over here.
Did you cook that chicken or was it raw chicken?
It's just raw. You know, you get more protein intake when you just cube it and pop it in.
That's good.
Oh, disgusting. Yeah.
Can you imagine that? That sounds awful.
What's your favorite nacho topping?
I love I'm in like a jalapeno phase right now.
Really?
I love like a good crispy jalapeno, cold, not heated up. I put it on afterwards.
I love
spice. I love heat. No. Fresh, freshly cut, freshly diced. Yeah, I love jalapenos. You guys don't like jalapenos?
I'm not spicy.
Yeah, you are. You're just different kind of spice.
I think my favorite nacho topping is probably the cheese, right? I mean, like, it feels like...
Yeah, the cheese is pretty good.
You like the cheese? Yeah.
You can put anything on nachos, but if it doesn't have cheese, it's not nachos. Yeah. It's like the chips and cheese are the two essential ingredients.
That's true. That's a good
word. But Kyle, you can't have any nachos. You want to know why?
Why?
Because they're nachos.
Because they're not mine. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say because he's lactose intolerant.
Yeah, I thought so too. I was like, wow, you're just really putting my business out there, aren't you, JT?
That's nacho cheese, Kyle.
I take those dairy pills, and every time I take one of those dairy pills, I feel like this is such an act of defiance against God, who was like, hey, I have not designed you to eat cheese. And then I was like, no, well, sorry, Lord, I'm going to eat these. I always feel like I'm defying
Speaking
God.
Speaking of idols and golden calves.
Yeah. I know, right?
I love golden, like literally golden.
Exactly.
I love when we're out eating dinner somewhere and Kyle gets those pills out. I'm like, Kyle came to win.
Oh, always. I'm not.
He's going for it.
I know. I feel like I'm defying God when I take those pills, and I feel like I'm defying God every time I get on a plane. It's like God was like, hey, I'm going to create birds. They're going to fly. You're not going to fly. And then man was like, see you later. I'm going up into the sky. And every time I get on a plane, I think God does not want me up here. I'm a terrible flyer. And I think it's because I feel like it's spiritual rebellion. But that's for another episode. Today, we are not talking about flying. We are talking about the golden calf. If you listened to the last episode, then you heard us give a recap of the story of Exodus so far. We are not going to do that again on this episode.
Praise God.
But if you do need a recap or a summary of the whole story of Exodus so far, you can go back and listen to the first 3 or 4 minutes of the episode from a couple of weeks back, and that'll give you the recap. Then you can jump back over here and jump into Exodus 32, which is one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible. I love Exodus 32. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
It's dark. That's really dark, Kyle.
Well, I just love it because I feel like Exodus 32 has like the spiritual experience in microcosm. If I was going to pick If I was going to pick a couple of God, like Old Testament gospel chapters, I think one of the chapters I'd pick would be Exodus 32, because I just think you get kind of a full saga of man's need for God, spiritual rebellion, and God's mercy and grace. You don't get the full story. Exodus 32 through 34 gives you that, but we're going to dive into this. And so to get us started, I'm going to read Exodus 32 verses 1 through 10, and then we will jump in to looking at the whole chapter. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early the next day. They offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you." Okay. Exodus 32, 1 through 10. Story of the golden calf. Let's start here. What is an idol and what is idolatry? Right? Let's begin there, because it is a story of idols and idolatry. But what is an idol? What is idolatry? And is this the only place that we find it in the story of the Bible?
Yeah, I'll jump in. I mean, so it comes, there's different terms that are used, kind of synonyms. Like, you could talk about it being an idol. The Greek term could be icon. A graven image is sometimes how it's translated. And it almost always refers to the actual verb usage, some kind of a carved or a hewn or an image that's been somehow melted down from, like what we're going to see in this passage today, to represent some other kind of deity or god or something that is meant to be worshipped. And I do think it's meant to be contrasted with icon or image that we see in Genesis, even as we were talking in the last episode, Genesis 1 and 2, God has made images for himself that are meant to give worship not to themselves, but to the creator. They are the icons through which all of creation looks at and ultimately looks through to worship the one true creator God. And that's why we're not supposed to make other ones, because they're not representative of the one true God. Even as we kind of come off last episode talking about the Sabbath and why we would do that as image bearers, those who reign and represent God and have the rhythms of God's life on the earth here. This is another thing where we're going to see. I love how you've been talking about this, the quick turn from Genesis chapter 30, Exodus 31 to 32. It kind of feels a little bit like Genesis 2 to Genesis 3. It's just like this really abrupt, "I've made image bearers for myself, who, here's how they're supposed to live." With Sabbath rest, we actually take God's creation and shape and form it into things that are meant to be worshipped, which is the exact opposite of what it's for.
That's right. And idolatry is certainly here. The golden calf is such a classic story. But idolatry is, it maybe is the one of the origin points for sin generally. So it shows up all the time. I mean, you think about in Genesis 3, part of Satan's appeal, the serpent's appeal to Adam and Eve, is that they will become God if they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They are already in the image of God. They are already like God, but the promise to them is that they will become God. And so while idols take on many forms and fashions throughout the story of the Bible, certainly we're going to hear, if you follow Israel's story, you're going to hear about idols of Baal and Ashtaroth poles, and you're going to find all sorts of different variations of idols and idolatrous things and graven images. But the fundamental root of Any worship of an idol is a spirit of idolatry, which is either to try to worship something in the hopes that it will make you into God, or to take a creaturely thing and exalt it into the place that only belongs to God and God alone, and to believe that in your worship of it, it will reward you or yield something that really can only be a blessing derived from the one true God. So idolatry is this spirit of giving oneself over to something that isn't God in a way that only properly belongs to God. And it takes on a lot of different methods.
Well, and I think we have to remember again where we are in the story, because, you know, we have Israel has been brought out of Egypt. And so there might be a moment in the story where we say, and thank goodness, because you know what the problem was? The problem was Egypt. Mm-hmm. And yet now what we find is that unmistakably the problem is not something outside of them. The problem, while it is that, it is also something inside of them that actually longs for what they had in Egypt. And we see that even in the image that it's formed, because when Aaron conceives of what he wants them to bow down and worship to, he conceives of a calf, which is a baby bull. And Apis is the fertility god of the Egyptian pantheon. And guess how Baal is represented in Canaan? As a bull. That's right. And so really what we're seeing here is that picture that JT has hinted at in other episodes we've talked about in various ways, is that if you view the first part of the story of Exodus as taking Israel out of Egypt, which would correspond to our justification, that we are delivered from the death that is our inheritance in sin. Now we find the second half of the book is getting Egypt out of Israel, or our sanctification, that even though we have been set free from the penalty of sin, we are now being set free from the power of sin, and progressively so. And so when we find Israel at this point in the story, they are about to learn something that they don't want to see is true about themselves. They want to see themselves as the children of God who are under Yahweh's protection, but they don't necessarily want to be under Yahweh's rule.
That's right.
And if you even look at the way that that this is said to them when Aaron sets up the image, he says, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." That's the opening lines of the Ten Commandments.
Right, yeah.
I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt. And so it's just going to be made poignantly clear. And I look at this too as an example of what a good parent will do, where you allow your children the opportunity to fail while the consequences are still low and they can learn from them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit of what we might see here, is that God, they have this opportunity to do the right thing, but they don't know, man. They haven't been in the wilderness that long. They're still figuring things out. They think Moses is a yahoo who's dead. And so maybe they need a plan B, which is a recurring theme, isn't it, in the Old Testament? You know, like, well, we thought we were going to do it God's way, but he's not showing up, so let's come up with our own plan. And I think God gives them this moment so that they will have, as we're going to see, a very clear illustration that there is no plan B.
That's right.
It's the way of Yahweh.
That's exactly right. And that journey of getting Egypt out of Israel is going to be a lot longer than the journey of getting Israel out of Egypt.
Yeah.
In some ways, truthfully, it hasn't stopped. Mm-hmm. And it won't stop until the kingdom comes in fullness. Like, Israel has a pattern that goes far beyond the book of Exodus of falling into the temptation of worshiping idols. It happens over and over and over again. If you want evidence, go look at Judges. The book of Judges is basically this testament of, like, okay, Israel returns to Yahweh in repentance and faith. Then they succumb to the worship of false gods and other nations. That happens again. Think about when Israel finally gets to their place in the land. They've built the temple. There's a Davidic king on the throne, Solomon, David's son, is worshiping the Lord. Israel is in the land. They have the temple. They have a king in God's line of rulers and those who are reigning. And what does Solomon do? He divides the kingdom because of disobedience that is rooted to the worship of false gods. It happens over and over and over again, and not just with Israel. You know, I can't read this story and not think of Calvin talking about the heart. You know, when Calvin talked about the human heart, he talked about it as an idol factory. Now, I'm paraphrasing him. He didn't say it in English, so I'm paraphrasing a translation of Calvin here. But he talked about that. I just wanted to be clear about that. You know, if any Calvin people out there is like, where am I going to find that? The heart is like an idol factory. It's constantly producing idols. This was true of Israel. It's true of us too as Christians. And I think that's one of the reasons I gravitate towards Exodus 32 is because it seems always relevant. Because in any life stage of the church, any of my sanctification with Christ, there is always a new idol emerging that is contending and vying for my allegiance, for my worship, for my fidelity, and for me to render unto it what only belongs to God. Like one of the things that I find most striking about Exodus 32 that hasn't been brought up yet is where does the gold come from? Mm-hmm. You know, when Aaron says, okay, give me your gold, your rings of gold there in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. And the people do it. They take off. Where did the gold come from? Mm-hmm. The gold was signs of their deliverance. They had been slaves in Egypt. Nobody, no Israelite in Egypt had gold. The rings of gold are the evidence that God has rescued them. They plundered the Egyptians. They took the riches of the Egyptians with them as they went. These rings of gold were to be signifiers to Israel as they walked into Canaan that Yahweh was with them. It was to be signifiers that they were not slaves, that they really were sons and daughters, not of Pharaoh, but of the King of Kings. They were really clothed in rich jewelry as a way of indicating and reminding themselves. And yet, what do they do here? They surrender that to create a false god. And that is such the spirit of idolatry, is taking these visible indicators, these good gifts of God, and exalting them far beyond what they were meant to do. They were meant to lead us back to the one true God. And we take a good gift from God and we make it into God himself. And this picture here of idolatry, I think, is so striking for that reason.
I think we have some recapitulation that's happening here from earlier accounts too, that Moses has already recorded for us. I think if you start with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So we have a saying in Texas. We say, you can take the boy out of Texas, but you can't take the Texas out of the boy.
Amen.
And you think about the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, you can take the family of Lot out of Sodom, but you can't take Sodom out of the family of Lot. Mm-hmm. And you think about, you know, Lot's wife, who, what does she do? She turns and she looks back and she gazes with longing on her deliverance from what was surely killing her. And so God turns her into a pillar of salt. And then we see that same thing in many ways when we see Jacob and his wives escape from Laban after their time of hard service in his care, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And what does Rachel do? She has in her saddlebags the household idols.
That's right.
She carries them out with her. So you can take the girl, you know, out of Ur, but you can't take Ur out of the girl. Mm. And then when we get here, we see the same pattern repeating with the whole nation of Israel at this point. And then, you know, you carry it all the way forward. This is not, I'm going to skip over a large section where these things do keep repeating, but we get all the way to the story of Revelation. And we see Babylon, and we see all of those who have traded upon her her waters, the ones who have become rich in profit after being in commerce with her. And Babylon representing all of the kingdoms of this world, anything that we opt into where we say, you know what, that's the kingdom that's to come, not the one that God said was to come. And what are all of these people doing? The kings, the seafarers, everyone who is profiting, they're turning around and saying, woe on this great city. And they're not sad because she's being destroyed. They're sad because they can no longer profit from her. And so, you know, all the way at the end of the Bible, we see these two distinct groups of people. We have those who dwell on the earth, and we have the saints. And those who dwell on the earth gaze on the demise of their idolatry, and they say, whoa, why? Because that's where they placed all of their hope. And it's the saints who cry out for the destruction of that. And so we see finally that the saints understand the cost of idolatry and the beauty of holiness. At the very end of the story. But here we're still seeing, you know, that Israel is being asked, are you going to look at this world as as your kingdom, or are you going to live as those whose God is coming down to you from on high and is inviting you into a different kind of kingdom?
Mm-hmm. How can Christians wholeheartedly pursue God without an undercurrent of guilt, fear, or anxiety? How can imperfect people experience God's peace while seeking to obey His perfect standards? Faith Chang writes to fellow Christian perfectionists in her new book, Peace Over Perfection. Discover the depths of God's patience, mercy, and righteousness, and find freedom to pursue Him with peace. Listeners get 25% off at thegoodbook.com with code KNOWING. That's Peace Over Perfection by Faith Chang. You can find it at thegoodbook.com and get 25% off with the code KNOWING. Meet your new favorite study companion. Immerse yourself in both the Old and New Testaments with the Holman Handbooks, brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible. I gotta tell you, I love these handbooks. They contain charts, maps, word studies, and more for each book of the Bible. They are some of my most used resources whenever I'm studying a passage. They intersect beauty, goodness, and truth, and they're designed to last a lifetime as a valuable resource for Bible study, teaching, and ongoing discipleship. They're available in two different cover options for each. Buy one, get one free at lifeway.com with the promo code HandbookBogo. Again, that is HandbookBogo on lifeway.com in order to get some of these Holman handbooks, HandbookBogo, Handbook BOGO on lifeway.com for these Holman handbooks. They are fantastic resources. That's really good. And so what is God's response to all of this? He calls them what? He says, look, they've turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and that I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. God's response is judgment, right? Holy judgment against this idolatry and this sin. He calls them a stiff-necked people. And, you know, commentators on this passage will say he's deliberately using this phrasing, stiff-necked people. He's basically saying they have become like what they worship. It's cattle imagery, stiff-necked people. He's calling them, basically, they're like cow people, right? They're wicked. They have become like the thing that they have constructed a idol around. But his response to it is judgment. Mm-hmm. It is wrath. Mm-hmm. In the same way that his response to the wickedness of Egypt was judgment and wrath. And yet there is a really big difference between Israel and Egypt. And what is that difference?
Some of them repent.
And what Egypt did not have that Israel does have is the foundation of a covenant relationship. And this is exactly how Moses implores the Lord in verse 11. It says, Moses implored God, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from the disaster against your people. And listen to Moses' appeal here. He says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self. Remember these people. Remember the promise that you've made to them, saying, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised, I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. And it says the Lord relented. So Moses' appeal to God is what? Remember your covenant promises. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to pause here. And JT, I want you to help us here a little bit. When Moses is appealing to God and saying, hey, God, remember, these are the children of Abraham. These are the children of Isaac. These are the children of Israel. Israel, there being a placeholder name for Jacob, Israel. When he's doing this, he's appealing to God on this basis. But maybe a casual reader might go, why does Moses need to remind God about these covenant promises? Is God so fickle as to forget them? So could you maybe just speak to a moment of this language here and maybe how to cut through what could be what could feel like a really easy way to understand remembrance language in the covenant appeal, but would be maybe a more helpful way to think through it?
Yeah, I mean, so maybe to simplify it a bit, Israel wants a God of convenience, but God maintains that he is still the God of covenant. They want a God that they can touch and see and it's a small little calf. It's non-threatening, but yet God is still the God of covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Just to take us back to that covenant in Genesis chapter 12, we need to be reminded that when God enters this covenant with Abraham, and this is the reason that Moses is going to appeal to it, is it is God himself who walks down in this covenant ceremony bearing this reality that he's going to be the one who suffers the consequences of Israel's disobedience when they are disloyal and unfaithful to the covenant. And he's also the one who's going to be faithful to the covenant. So one of the things that we need to see here, and this would be true not just with covenantal language and historical books like this, but also with the prophets. This is true in wisdom literature like the Psalms, is we actually see a deep, deep, deep sense of trust when God's people, reminder isn't the right word, but they take God back to this covenant. One of my favorite authors says, the ultimate form of trust is when God's people proclaim God's promises and put them back in front of his face, is ultimately what it's saying. It's almost like, this might not be the perfect analogy, but like I've got, you know, 2 little ones, 8 and 6 years old. When they come to me and say, hey, Dad, you, like, for example, last night, you know, we went over to some friends to watch the football game. And it wasn't time to go yet. Now, I knew we were going. We had plans to go. We had all the snacks ready to go. And but then we kind of rested after church for a little bit. And my little girl came up to me and said, hey, Dad, remember, we're going to go to our friend's house for the football game. And she wasn't reminding me of something that I had forgotten, but she was coming to Dad as a form of trust in saying, I believe that when Dad says something, Dad means it and that we're going to do it. And she's coming to me and saying, hey, remember, Dad, you said this, not because she's concerned that we're going to do it or not, but actually as a deep form of trust. I think that's what Moses is doing here. He is not all of a sudden believing God is fickle. He isn't believing that God has forgotten. He's actually saying, God, you're the God who said this, and I know that you're going to be the one who's going to do it. I know that your word is trustworthy. So I'm bringing this before you because I want you to know that I trust your word. That's what's happening here. It's Moses saying, I trust what you said. I trust what you said to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've written those accounts and I've written those words down. I want you to know that I trust it.
That's right. And that's so well said. And we see this kind of appeal all throughout the story of the Bible. The psalmist will routinely say, hey, God, this is where we're at right now. And I am speaking back to you in prayer what you have already promised and assured me of. We'll find this here. We'll find it in the prophets. The prophets will routinely appeal to the covenant that God has made in order to not... It's not to whitewash or to rationalize the disobedience of Israel. It's to call down the faithful presence of God, even in the midst of the faithlessness of his people. In some ways, Jesus Christ will do the same things as he enters into his ministry to proclaim what's true, even in the face of those who, in the name of God, are rejecting God. And he's making it very clear to them, this is what God has said, and this is where you have misunderstood, misbelieved, or misrepresented it. Moses is functioning here in a mediatorial role, and this is a type or a picture, a function that definitely is going to ripple throughout the rest of the story of the Bible. Moses, his intercession here is a picture of what the mediator is supposed to do, which is to represent God's people before God and to represent God before God's people. And so in his intercession, which will continue in Exodus 33 in a really beautiful way, Moses is appealing to God saying, this is what you have promised and what you have said. I believe it. Now continue to operate in accordance with it so that you will be faithful even in the face of the faithlessness of your people. And it says that the Lord hears Moses and he relents. The Lord relents from the judgment, but there is a judgment. He relents from blotting them out. Mm-hmm. He relents from categorical destruction of all of Israel, right? In many ways, he relents from a flood-style judgment, mm-hmm. right? Because he tells Moses, I'm going to wipe them away and I'll make a great nation out of you. It feels a little bit like Noah and his family in the pre-flood moment where it's like, okay, I'll start over with you. So it feels a little bit like God is saying, I'm going to do to Israel what I once did to their ancestors, and I will preserve you through it so to make a great nation out of you. And yet Moses implores him to relent, and he does. It says that Moses then says he turns, he goes down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. It says, when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp. But he said, it is not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear. And as he gets there, it says that his anger burned hot. He threw the tablets out of his hands. He broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made, burned it with fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the people of Israel drink it. This is an interesting thing. I just went through this story with my daughter in our Bible study curriculum on Fridays, and we talked a lot about why that, right? Mm-hmm. Is there any reason, Jen, that you can think of in terms of the judgment here? Why does it take this form?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's similar to some other tests that we'll see elsewhere in the Old Testament, tests for infidelity. Mm-hmm. There's one, a test that's supposed to be administered to a wife who's suspected of infidelity. But I also think that what we're seeing here has echoes of sweet water made bitter.
Yeah.
Instead of bitter water made sweet. Mm-hmm. I think that because again, that's another image that we see resurface when we get to Revelation. And it's basically saying, I will make bitter for you that thing that you think is a sweetness. You think that these idols are going to save you and they're not. And so it's symbolic, I think, as much as it's anything else. But it is symbolic in a really important and I think identifiable way to the children of Israel, because remember, he has already made sweet water for them from bitter water. And really what we see in the way that this whole scene plays out, if you'll remember what God said to, actually what he said to Israel at the point that he made the bitter water sweet, was, hey, if you will obey my commands, I will not send on you the plagues mm-hmm. that I sent on Egypt. But what are we seeing here? He effectively does send That's a plague right. on his own people. Right. Because here's the deal. When we talk about the faithfulness of God, it's important for us to remember God is faithful both to bless and to discipline That's his right. children. And so I tell this to parents of small children all the time, that if you don't follow through on a consequence for something, you're communicating to your child that you're not trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And so people don't always think about it that way. And so you think about our Heavenly Father here, who's our much better parent. You know, he's the perfect parent. And that's what we're seeing, I think, play out in this portion of the narrative.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I was hoping you'd make that connection with the bitter waters made sweet, because I do think, and the Nile turning to blood, which, you know what I'm saying, is another picture here. But you're right. He does send a plague on to Israel this way. And it is a reminder, like you said, that God is, he is covenantally bound to Israel, and he has rescued them because of those covenant promises. But it also doesn't mean that every other nation gets judgment except for Israel. Mm-hmm. God is equitable mm-hmm. in his judgment. He will not acquit the guilty. And even though Moses mediates and intercedes on behalf of Israel and saves them from the full pouring out of the wrath of God that would end with their categorical death and destruction, there is a judgment here, because he scatters the water on him. It makes them drink that. He also too, and I think this might feel uncouth, is I know what the word my mother would use, might feel a little uncouth to say, but they have taken the gold meant as a symbol of their deliverance, melted it down and turned it into an idol. And now it is going to become waste product for them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this, Mom, in the most couth way I can, but they are going to drink this water with this dust on there, you know, this gold powder that's been ground down on there. And then like you do as a human with what you consume, it is going to become human waste. So this thing that they built and exalted, God is essentially saying, hey, this idol that you melted down the gold of your deliverance to make, that you exchanged worshiping me for, not only am I going to bring your worship to a judgmental end, that thing that you thought you could worship and praise and it would grant you something, I'm going to have you consume it, and it is going to become biological waste product. That is a... Go ahead.
No, finish your biological waste product statement.
No, do you want me to keep talking about biological? How many more times can I talk about biological waste without saying uncouth words?
Well, here's the other reference I thought of as you were giving your diatribe on human waste. Isaiah 44:20. In Isaiah 44, it's a diatribe on idolatry. And it says, of the idolater, it says, he feeds on ashes. A deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, is there not a lie in my right hand? So, you know, in reference to holding the idol. And so I think that we're seeing that here too as well, that he feeds on ashes. And again, when you then take that back, you know, to the creation narrative, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, like you are, he says to the serpent, you are from dust and to dust you will return. Or he says to the man, and he says the serpent will eat dust all the days of his life. And so it's all of this, you know, look what's happening here. I'm making you see the relationship that you have to the creation and what happens when you worship the creation instead of the creator.
That's right.
Also what you said about
it's okay.
Human excrement there. I said. Yeah,
never mind. this is not the only judgment though. It says that when Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them loose, Moses stood at the gate of the camp, said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me." And all the sons of Levi, this, as we know already, is going to become the core of the priesthood. He said to them, "Says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor." The sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. So there is bloodshed. Mm-hmm. Now, we know, because we're going to find this out, and it's already been told in Exodus, but without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Blood is the debt payment that is due for sin, for evil, for idolatry. So even among God's covenant people here, now I think this is important to remember. They walked out of Egypt under blood-covered doorpost. And when they forgot that and exchanged the worship of God, the God who had atoned for them, the God who had covered them with the blood of a spotless lamb, when they exchanged that for a false god, what then was due? Blood. Mm-hmm. A blood payment. And we talked about this last season when we were talking about why the blood, if you're interested in why the blood is so significant as a part of the story of the Bible generally, why it's needed for the forgiveness of sins. We did a whole episode on that, but I don't want to rush past this because it is not merely that God's judgment is averted in Moses' intercession. It's that Moses really steps in here almost in a way as the angel of death to step in to say there must be a judgment. There must be a bloodshedding. Israel had escaped from the loss of life because of the kindness of God. And now that they have presumed it in order to have as a foundation for the worship of a false god, now judgment comes in a form that they otherwise would have averted. And I think that's significant. God doesn't kick Israel out of his covenant. He doesn't say to all of Israel, guess what? Forget you. I'm going to kill you all. Moses intercedes. The people are rescued. And yet there is still a shedding of blood that is required here. And Moses acknowledges that. He says, the next day you have sinned a great sin, and now I'll go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses returned to the Lord. And listen to this last part, because I think this is where I want us to end. What does this sound like to us in verse 31? So Moses returned to the Lord, says, "This people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." But the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go lead the people to the place about which I've spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them." Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf. Moses' request here is the mediatorial request. God, I know they have sinned against you, but don't blot them out of your book. Blot me out of, he's asking to be a substitute.
Right.
But he can't be, right? He can't be the substitute for Israel. He's an imperfect mediator.
Oh, yeah, he's imperfect and he's finite. You know,
that's right.
The thing about a temporal or a finite sacrifice is it might be a substitute once, but it can't be an ongoing sacrifice, which is what we need. Or we need the one who is eternal to make the once for all sacrifice.
That's right.
Which is what Jesus does.
And this is what the writer of Hebrews pulls in, right? The covenant with Christ is better than the covenant with Moses. Why? Because Christ is a better mediator of a better covenant. Moses is a shadow of Jesus because Moses could not be the substitute for the people of Israel. He could not be blotted out on behalf of the people. And yet that's exactly what Christ does. He is mm-hmm. blotted out. He is crushed for our transgressions. Upon him is the sin of God's people placed. He is a substitute that Moses could never have been. Moses' request here is the right request for a substitutionary mediator to make. It's just that Moses can't bear it. And God knows mm-hmm. that. He's not an acceptable sacrifice.
Well, and I think, you know, this scene really ends up carrying a lot of irony because we know that Moses will not lead them into the promised land. Like here he says, I don't want to go if you won't go with us. And then ultimately God will have to say to him, you're not going in. And so we're not allowed to see Moses as the perfect mediator in any stretch because he, unlike Christ, who leads us in victory into our Sabbath rest, Moses stands afar off and gazes upon it from a That's distance. Right. Hmm. So it's always interesting to me how, like, you know, it sounds like such a smarty pants thing to say, but like, why didn't Israel see that Moses couldn't have been the mediator, you know, when his failures are recorded here for us? But I do think it's interesting that Moses himself becomes an idol to the people of Israel by the time of Jesus' day. And you think about how Moses would have hated that, even based on this story. And then just a failure to recognize the true mediator when he comes along. And I think that we're meant to feel all of that. I think that those who are familiar with the Old Testament narratives then carry those into those gospel accounts and can see just how truly backwards things are by the time that we see the ministry of Christ beginning. And so, therefore, it's all the more celebratory when we get to Revelation and see that that final and perfect mediator does indeed show up on a white horse to lead his people into the Sabbath rest.
That's right. Well, I hope you enjoyed the discussion. On our next episode on Exodus, we'll continue to walk through this, looking at Exodus 33 with Moses' intercession and really asking ourselves about the presence of the Lord and why it is such the distinct mark of God's people. You can find Knowing Faith on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we encourage you to go give us a follow wherever you're at on social media. We think we have a great audience on those platforms. Everybody keeps it real civil and charitable and fun. And that's what we try to do as well. So if you're somebody who wants to become kind of a bad actor, then don't go follow us on social media. But if you want a good dose of some fun and some theology, find Knowing Faith on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the show today. Don't forget to check out our sponsors who make the show possible. You can look in the show notes and you can find links to everything that we talked about on the show. Go give them a look. We try to really only recommend things that we think are credible and worth your time. And that leads me to 10 of those. We love 10ofthose.com. They're a great partner. They have done us the great service of setting up a bookstore with every book we've ever recommended on the show, including commentaries we like on Exodus, books about Exodus, a book called 10 Words to Live By that's written by somebody who had something to say about the 10 Commandments. You can find all of those at 10ofthose.com/knowingfaith, including the book we'll be talking about next week. On the next episode, we'll be looking at G.K. Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy. This is one of my favorite books in the history of the church. I love it so much. I cannot wait to talk about this book. If you're only going to read one of the books that we're recommending on this season of Knowing Faith, I got to tell you selfishly, I'd want it to be Orthodoxy.
Don't listen to JT.
I'd love for you to read Orthodoxy. Let me mute JT. Boom, there we go. If you want to help make this show possible in the future, you can go to trainthechurch.com/support. There's a newsletter that we send out that can give you some behind the scenes stuff. There's also some cool ways to get involved with early episodes, ad-free episodes. And we'd love for you to check that out. If you haven't had a chance to look at what Tiny Theologians and the Family Discipleship Podcast are doing, you are missing out. They have released some incredible episodes so far this season. If you're looking for a podcast to teach Christian truth to your young kiddos, I don't think there's anyone better doing it than Amy Kate Gannett and her team over at Tiny Theologians, and we love partnering with them. So go check out what is my daughter's favorite podcast, The Tiny Theologians. So we hope you enjoy the discussion today. Grace and peace. Boom. Did this episode spark an interest to learn more about Jesus, the Bible, or theology? You can receive free theological training through Midwestern Seminary's For the Church Institute, which offers courses in Old and New Testament, Christian theology, and more, including the newly released course on missional leadership. Again, this is free theological training that you can use for your own equipping, for the equipping of those in your church, and it is available for groups or on your own. You can learn more and get started today at ftcinstitute.com. Again, that's ftcinstitute.com for theological training courses, free theological training courses today. Go check it out.